Hi, this is Katie Day and welcome to Creating Ripples, the programme that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh, sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Anna Atkinson. Anna has been working as a transpersonal arts counsellor for 6 years, having trained at the Alternative Tobias School of Art and Therapy, whose training programme places an emphasis on healing through a more holistic and gentle approach to creativity. She originally obtained a degree in illustration at the University of Arts at Camberwell College of Art in London, which led to an interest in using the creative impulse as a way to illustrate stories and ideas. Anna has worked extensively in primary, secondary and sixth form schools in London and Sussex, helping to facilitate creative educational interventions for individuals and groups, particularly in relation to challenging behavioural needs in financially and culturally deprived areas, where often therapeutic provisions are scarce. Anna has worked as a crisis counsellor and arts in mental health practitioner, and also runs seasonal workshops and groups based on different themes and works of literature such as Kafka, Grimm's fairy tales, and the poetry of Rumi, Hafiz, and David White. Anna's practice incorporates art, sound, words, movement, texture, creative writing, installation, film, voice, colour, and bodywork, with an emphasis on the intuitive voice and the power of being witnessed. Anna regularly practices poetry, drama, art and dance as a form of meditation and prayer. She believes everyone is an artist and every small act is an expression of creative energy if paid attention to and honoured. Her hope is that people learn to honour their creative landscapes and give nourishment to their artistic appetites in order to blossom more fully than they ever anticipated. Wow, that is some bio. Reading that, I'm thinking, God, that's so interesting. I want to ask you that, and I want to ask you about that, and I want to ask you about that. That's amazing. Thank you for being interviewed.
Pleasure.
Absolutely fascinating. Particularly, which out of all of that did I pick up that really kind of went boing, boing, boing? The one phrase I really, really liked was with an emphasis on the intuitive voice and the power of being witnessed. That particular statement really leapt out of the page at me. Mm-hmm. Tell me more about what you mean about the power of being witnessed.
So this is something I first came across in my dance practice.
Right.
I'm a really sort of avid practicer of five rhythms, which is a dance.
I've heard of that, but I don't really know what it is.
It's it was formulated by Gabrielle Roth in California.
Right.
She passed away a couple of years ago, I think, but she's, you know, that her movement practice is still held in lots of places.
Right.
Globally, but there is a practice in Hastings, and there's also lots of it. It's quite a growing practice in London. Mm. But one of the really beautiful aspects of it is that quite often you will dance and be watched dancing. So the group will split in half and one half will sort of watch and the other half will dance. And obviously there's all that kind of fear that comes up thinking, oh, I can't be watched dancing. But it's part of a process, and so you've done lots of work beforehand and kind of move into it. And they're not watching from a judging place, they're watching from a sort of compassionate place, and quite often the people watching will be moved to tears. And it's that realizing that that dance you have that you might be embarrassed about or nervous to share is actually incredibly touching for someone to witness. And it's just realizing that what we have to offer may not seem much to us, and it may feel difficult to bring out into the world, but actually if we dare to, it can touch other people. So it's like, if we allow ourselves to be seen, it can be really difficult to be seen and to be heard.
Okay.
And we are actually really scared of it.
Mm.
But actually, when we do allow ourselves, we do take that risk, it's so expansive and people can, you know, it's a connector.
Mm.
People can then connect to us. And yeah, it's about being brave enough to say, this is my art, this is my piece. this is who I am. And we're so often terrified of that, because when we were younger, we probably did a piece of art and we got told it was rubbish, or we got told we couldn't sing, we couldn't dance. All of the, you know, the things like singing, dancing, storytelling, doing art, these are all things that we do as children so instinctively. We play naturally, and that's kind of taken out of us as we get older. And then we think that it's not worthy. We think we might get judged. So the first step is to share it. But, you know, even if it's a tiny, tiny sharing.
Is because, well, I think what came out for me from that statement was the power of being witnessed. And, you know, a lot of what I do, I am putting myself out there. With the interviewing, you know, I get up on stage, I talk to thousands of people, I'm a trainer. I do a lot of being witnessed. But the moment you mention the word dance, I can feel myself shriveling inside, thinking, oh, not in a month of Sundays would you get me to do that. I just, shivers of terror go through my body. What is it about dance that presses so many buttons for so many people?
I think it's because, so I've had lots of therapy, talking therapy with various therapists as part of my training. I had to undergo, I've had about 7 years worth of therapy, talking therapy. But I have found, of all the stuff I've tried, all the, you know, crystal healing, all the stuff, the most powerful has been movement, because it bypasses words, it bypasses language, and you are you're embodied, you're connecting with your body. And so often, the trouble we have is that our minds are disconnected from our bodies. We're kind of taught to think in our heads all the time. You know, we're on our phones, we're on our computers, we're in our heads, and they're almost cut off from our bodies. Quite often in our jobs, you know, we're not enabling our bodies to move. And there's I mean, I know people that dance and they say it's the easiest way to meditate, easier than sitting cross-legged.
Interesting.
Humming, because in a way you're moving. So it's kind of being in the flow of movement. And it's not about looking good or dancing well. It's just about allowing energy to move through your body in whatever way feels right. So it might be that you need to do an angry movement. It might be that you need to wiggle your fingertips, or it's about really listening into the body. So you can kind of do that in lots of creative ways. So you can sort of think, okay, what colour are my legs right now? What texture are they made of? What are they, what do they need to say? What do they feel? And all the time, you know, our bodies are radars for all that's going on with us. And actually, if we need to get in touch with ourselves, we literally just need to close our eyes and notice what's going on in our bodies. Because it's always there.
Interesting. Yeah, you're right. Because some of the work that I do with people, I ask them to do a body scan, which is a similar thing, actually. And I strongly believe that our bodies will tell us everything we need to know. We just don't shut up long enough to listen.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I guess this is a way of connecting with your subconscious.
Yes.
Because we live so much in our ego, don't we? Or our conscious mind, which actually only runs about 10 to 20% of us.
Yeah.
But we allow it to actually dominate probably 80%.
Of
our behaviour, our decisions, our choices, our thought processes, our emotions. We allow that ego that lives in the conscious mind to take over and make decisions that aren't always appropriate. But if we shut that up long enough and allow our subconscious to speak, we've actually got all the answers. So I hadn't actually thought that dance could be a way of doing that.
I think people are scared of the word dance. If you call it movement, I think people are a bit less nervous of it. But there is that the sense of flow is really important, that being in the flow. And it takes, so at the beginning of a five rhythms class, you go through five rhythms. The first one is flow, and that's connected to experience. So it's just going into your body, just the gentle slowing down. And that takes about half an hour normally to actually let go of the day and go into your body. And you don't realise how much you're not in that until you let go of the words and actually drop in. And it's kind of like what you said about the ego. You know, if we want to listen to the voice of intuition, we need to go into the heart, into the body. The head doesn't, it's not always the most intuitive place, whereas the body is. Quite often, you know, if we're, I mean, a perfect example is last week was the last week of term, and I was just had a lot of things on, and I was really run down, really exhausted, and I walked into a lamppost.
Oh, gosh.
And I, And my knee was all grazed. And I thought, that's just such a sign that my body's disengaged from my head and I need to stop and I need to rest and I need to listen. And it's just the classic, you know, quite often people, when they run down, they get a cold. Their body's telling them, whoa.
Slow down and stop.
You do need to listen to it. Traditionally in prayer, people say your hands together, eyes closed. And that's just a way of connecting internally to the internal space. You know, if we put our hands together and close our eyes, we're naturally going inwards.
Okay.
Which is that
interesting
place of listening.
Yeah. And I suppose also if we close our eyes, we're not getting that visual stimulus that will take us out of connecting with the bodies, are we?
Yeah, and we're so overstimulated all the time.
Here we are.
Yeah.
And but we're overstimulated with the wrong things.
Yes, that's the
word. We were having a discussion, weren't we, before the interview started about London.
Yeah.
And you were in London yesterday, and I was saying, you know, I'm in London a couple of times a week, and I absolutely adore London. When I get off the train in London, I feel this energy, this heartbeat go through me, which I feel myself getting this kind of zing, and I love the madness of it. I love the noise. I love the crowds. I love the pushing and the shoving. I love the multicultural aspect of it. I adore that. I just love the buzz and the heartbeat of London. Mm-hmm. But after a day, I need to come back down to the coast. And when that train, particularly this time of the year, because it doesn't get dark until late, so whatever time I'm coming home, usually it's still light. And you see the fields, you see the landscape expanding in front of you. And then you start to smell the sea. It's better.
Absolutely.
So it's the right kind of stimulus, isn't it? Do you think we can get addicted to the wrong kind of stimulus and that has an impact on the body?
Yes, in a way. I was thinking, yes, I was laughing yesterday because I went to see a group of friends that live in London and they said, oh, come to Clapham Common and we'll have a picnic. And I think of all the things I could do on a day trip to London, finding the nearest tiny small square of like rather rubbish grass down covered in pigeons and have a picnic. You know, I'd much rather do that where I live, where it's like amazing landscapes to sit and have a picnic. And I'm thinking that a lot of my London friends they're so overstimulated, they don't want to go to the museums all the time. They naturally want to gravitate to that tiny small square of grass.
Yeah.
And I was the same when I lived in Peckham. I used to spend a lot of time in Peckham Rye Park, which, you know, it was kind of like my saviour. But actually, I look at it now and I think, oh, it was just a square of grass, you know, relatively, compared to these big, beautiful, like you say, expansive landscapes that we live, you know, we're lucky to live near here. But I think in terms of addiction, well, I mean, I think, you know, the internet, I'm definitely guilty of that, going on my phone, going on the internet, missing the beautiful train view out the window because I'm looking on my phone. I think it's trying to find a balance. I mean, I don't really watch TV, which I find is something that I'm, you know, quite appreciate because I think I then take more time to read or write. I think we just need to be vigilant around what we take in, and I think there's something about discipline that needs to be around. And I think that if we want to harness creativity, there is an element of discipline involved. And it doesn't have to be a huge, horrible, you know, we think of discipline, we think, oh, no, I'm going to be, you know, made to paint for hours. It's not, it's more about tiny discipline. And I think it's just in the small things, in the habitual things.
Okay.
So it's whether it's, I went to see an amazing talk the other day, amazing artist, and she was saying that she gets up every morning and writes in her journal and just takes note of the climate, the weather, how it is, you know, almost like a poem. How is it outside today? What's the view outside my window? What can I see? And, you know, just that little daily practice of doing that, in those small things, I think, or taking a daily walk, or so that you've always, you know, you keep that practice just as much as you keep the checking on your phone practice or checking on your emails practice. And we almost have to actively do it now because we naturally check our emails every day without thinking about it, but we don't always naturally think, oh, have I taken a walk today, or
it's true. At the moment, it's interesting, my reaction, I noticed my reaction when you said the word discipline, and my reaction was discipline and creativity don't go hand in hand. But that's my assumption, because, you know, my assumption is that creativity is random and free and organic. And discipline, to me, and this is my own baggage coming up in relation to that word, is that discipline represents rigidity and rules. And I'm not very good with rules. Yeah. I usually kick against them. So immediately I thought, oh, I don't like that word, discipline.
I love what you just said there, because you've said you normally kick against them.
Mm.
And in order to be creative, we need the walls to kick against. We need that resistance.
Oh, okay.
We need that boundary. So with anything, so there's a great book. I can't remember. It's 12 Rules of Creativity. It's there's a series of them. And one of the things that I think he's a designer or something that wrote it, and he was saying that actually your boundaries are your creative tools. So say you've got a piece of paper, a biro, and, you know, you're stuck in a lift. They are your tools. And actually, I've noticed that I can sometimes do more on a train journey than I can when I'm sat at home and I've got all the distractions in the world to keep me from it. Whereas when I'm sort of in quite a bounded space, I'm much more productive in a way. We need some bound, like children do.
Yep, true.
We don't give children boundaries. They're all over the place. They're chaotic.
They don't feel safe,
They're not safe. They're not contained. So, you know, that's why therapy works so well, because it's such a boundaried practice.
Yeah, true.
You only see your therapist for an hour a week.
Yep.
You don't have contact with them outside of that. So all of that is what makes us feel safe. And actually, it's about learning to befriend your boundaries, because boundaries are always going to be there. We just have to learn to harness them and work with them and use the boundaries themselves as a tool.
Mm.
So...
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, a really weird thing popped into my head then. I don't know. It's very random. But I suppose it was picking up on the comment you made about sometimes when you're on the train, so you've got the boundaries of that you're constricted in a small space.
Yeah.
You haven't got the distractions that you've got at home that will get in the way.
Yeah.
So it's easier to kind of go with your mind and just kind of focus in.
Mm.
Yeah. On what you need to do. So it makes it almost easier to make the choices and the decisions. And what popped into my head really weirdly was, in a previous incarnation, I worked in the city.
Mm.
And I worked with a lot of Eastern European women just after communism fell and the wall fell. So it was in the early 1990s. And their experience, it was a women's personal development program, and it was their experience of coming from Eastern Europe to Western Europe and how they were reacting to that experience. And the one thing that stuck in my mind from one woman who said, I can't cope in your supermarkets.
Oh.
So I said, okay, that's interesting. Why? She said, because there's too much choice.
Oh, yeah.
She said, back home, I think it was Romania, we had so little that it made the choosing really simple.
Yeah.
But I walk into your supermarkets and I'm so overwhelmed, I don't know where to start. I find myself getting emotional and panicking and I run out.
Oh, I think that's quite normal, actually. I think supermarkets do have that effect. And I think that's a really beautiful example. I think it's true. I think that's, again, it's the overstimulation.
It's the overstimulation, isn't it? And too much choice sometimes can paralyze us rather than allowing us to express ourselves. So sometimes I can actually see now how that kind of discipline, the boundaries, can actually help us release more of what's inside us.
Yeah.
Rather than the outside overwhelming us.
Yeah. It's almost like, you know, when people have, you know, kind of, you know, have tons of money and they can kind of live whatever life they can. There's almost this real sense of loneliness with that. And whereas people that, you know, kind of live within their means and do their best, and, you know, there's something holding about that. Mm. Whereas if you just, I don't know, the boundaries can bring safety and a sense of, well, I'm going to work with what I've got. It's like when you make a recipe, you can make the most interesting thing if you've got, you know, those things that you need to use up. Sometimes something amazing comes from it. I think it can be more to, I mean, less is more, they always say, don't they? And I think sometimes having less at your disposal can mean that you can be more creative with it.
But you have to tap into other things, don't you? Yeah. Maybe things in you that you didn't realise were actually there. They were just kind of lying dormant until they were given the right environment to suddenly start to blossom and to come out and have a voice, I guess, isn't it? Do you find that there's a lot within people that doesn't have the opportunity to have a voice?
I think so. I think we quite often silence some of our voices. We pick a personality that we want to have, and we go with that, and we might change our personality slightly depending on who we're with, you know, if we're with our boss or with our best mate or whatever. But there's all these really interesting sub-personalities that we have. And I've been doing an interesting practice recently, which is sort of part of my drama work. It's called Nordic LARP, which is...
Good Lord, what's that?
It's a Nordic tradition, and it comes from this idea of live-action role-play. And I know you're probably thinking... I know a lot of people, when I say this, they think, oh, you know, people reenacting battles and things.
Okay.
It's kind of very different to that, the Nordic version of it. It quite often takes quite an ordinary, everyday situation, and then people can inhabit a character, but your script gets sort of half written, you get parts of it, and then you write the rest yourself.
Oh, interesting.
So it's kind of like a bit like improv.
Yeah, yeah.
Theatre. And I've been doing a bit of that, and I'm amazed at these characters that I end up inhabiting are very different to me, but there's something in me that needs to come out through them. And I, you know, it's like permission to be maybe someone I don't normally allow myself to be. And it's like, oh, actually that seed was in me all the time. I just really needed permission to let that side of me out.
Mm.
And actually we really zing with people when they suddenly give us access to a seed in us we didn't know we had. And then, you know, that's when we really kind of feel connected to other people, is when they allow those parts of us that we normally silence to blossom and grow. But quite often when we become too habitual, we can kind of shut those other voices, those other parts down. And again, it's that sort of practice of going, actually, you know, my anger's really healthy, it's really good. My jealousy is okay, it's allowed. And, you know, giving permission to all those things that we might think as nasty or not sociable, or quite often it's those sort of like ugly parts of us that actually, when you really give them permission, can come to something so beautiful, more than the nice parts, because often the nice ones are a bit, might be a bit passive aggressive.
Well, they can be.
Yeah, but actually if we really sink into the nitty-gritty of the yucky things and own them, because often we project them onto other people, but if we just own it within ourselves, so you can kind of come to a really great creative place. And actually often when you're making artwork, you quite often have to go through a phase of hating it
sometimes. Oh, do you
get through the other side? I think sometimes you have to go, it's like when you're writing a book or something, in order to get through that experience of like staying with a novel, you know, that you've been writing for years and years, you kind of will go through periods of not liking it. Just as, you know, when you're in a committed relationship with someone, you know, you might have times where you can't stand to be in the same room as them. But it's part of intimacy, and it's part of, we kind of have to go through that journey to come out the other end.
Yeah, I was just thinking, because I wrote a book a few years ago, and that I found a very easy process. It wasn't fiction. It was based on my training. And I suppose my passion to get the message out there to as many women as possible was what motivated me to write the book. But I had no fear in putting it out there. But I have huge fear of doing something creative where I'm being witnessed. And I suppose the thing with the book is I have no idea who's reading it.
Yeah.
So I'm not witnessing their reaction.
Yeah.
But if I'm in the same room with somebody, I am witnessing their reaction. Yeah. And it's that bit that makes you go, oh, no, I can't do that.
Wow. That's really interesting. Yeah. That's probably true, actually. And I've had friends, you know, that I've known for ages come to my workshops that knew me before I did any therapy or anything like that. And I've felt more shy and, you know, not kind of held back, you know, by them being there, and they're so familiar to me, and yet that's
well, it's more scary doing stuff in front of people we know than it is doing it in front of strangers.
And how often do we not say what we really think to our closest family? You know, I think often the closer people are, the harder it is to and there's something, you know, there's that freedom, isn't there, when we go somewhere and we're anonymous. I think that's why London was great, actually.
Very addictive. Yeah. It's very, very addictive.
That's why London is great, because you can just, you know, you are anonymous and you can be whoever you want to be and no one's going to think otherwise.
Yeah. And you can reinvent yourself.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point 3 years ago where I nearly emigrated to the States.
Mm.
And right at the last minute, I changed my mind. And I really looked at what was my motivation. And I realised that I mean, I love the States and I love the people, but I was running away because of what had happened 2 years before when my guard came down and my girlfriends took over my life. I got really close to all of my girlfriends.
Yeah.
So suddenly there was nowhere to hide anymore. Mm. And they really got me. They really saw me. They really knew me. I'd opened up my soft underbelly. And suddenly I realised, oh, this is a little bit uncomfortable. If I go to Pasadena, nobody knows who I am. And yeah. I can just pretend again.
Yeah.
So there is a real safety, isn't there, yeah. in that anonymity?
Yeah.
A real safety. And it is taking a deep breath and pushing through that feeling of uncomfortableness and slight sort of itchiness. Mm. You've kind of got this new cloak on and it's itching a bit. And you yeah. just have to settle into it, don't you? And think, actually, no, it's all right.
Yeah.
I want to talk about the work you do with children because I think that's fascinating. What I've witnessed over the years I've been working is that education is very focused on left brain creativity, not right brain creativity. So if you are a child who is naturally brilliant at maths and the sciences, you are celebrated in education.
Yeah.
If you're not, you're not.
Yeah.
So there is a danger that you could leave school feeling stupid.
Yeah.
How do you make it safe for children to express the right brain creativity and to be celebrated within that space?
Well, this is a really, great thing that you're talking about, because actually this is something that's really present for me. I've been working with children in local primary school for about 3 years, and only this year been given much more permission to focus on that art. Before I was doing all subjects, but I've said, it's really important that we do more art, and I've managed to get leeway in just working with the creative stuff with the children. And it's like they are so desperate to be seen in that. They, because they feel like some children can't read or write, they're terrible at math, or, they just think that they're not good for anything. And when you start to introduce creativity, and the main thing about creativity with children is the sensory aspect. So quite often when children, until they're at least 10, they don't have that sort of judgment brain that we have as adults. Mm. They don't think, oh, that's terrible, or that's, increasingly they probably do. But what children naturally create anyway, they naturally have this amazing sensory engagement. If you watch a child, put its hands under a tap, they can spend hours washing their hands.
Yeah. And it's true.
Or smells, or, they... Children desperately want to engage in a sensory way with their environment, just as babies do. You watch a baby looking around a room, or they naturally do. And if you give them permission to do that, so you're not telling them that they've got to do this great piece of artwork, it's not got to look like anything, you just give them some paint or some sensory material, some clay, and say, go for it. It's that amazing how quickly they engage. Whether they're academic or not, it's almost in all children. But I think those children specifically that don't feel they excel in the academic stuff, it's like they found this new language to express themselves.
Yeah.
But they really need encouraging. They need telling that there isn't a right or wrong way to do it. I mean, instantly when I see children for art, the first thing they say to me is, oh, I can't draw. I think, yes, you can draw. Everyone can draw. It's a language that we have, but you've been told that you can't, or you've been made to feel you can't. Mm. But actually, drawing is a very small aspect of art, and there's millions of other ways we can express things. It doesn't have to be even with tools. It could just be through voice or drama or dance. But then I just think it's such an important way of engaging with the world. But I was thinking, because my training was to do with Steiner education.
Ah, interesting.
Yeah, which I don't necessarily agree with all of it, but one of the aspects of Steiner education is that they don't start doing the academic stuff till a lot later.
Mm.
And they focus on the children as individuals.
Mm.
They really focus on what the child homes in on, and naturally let the child sort of kind of move towards that.
Mm.
So they don't put so many parameters on things. Mm. And they encourage that sensory engagement. And often they, work with colour or wooden toys and things that don't have iPads and things. It's very untechnology, which you could say this, maybe not preparing them for the world, but they're engaging in a much more sensory way, and they end up being academically very bright, but they just do it in a slower pace,
much better.
It's much more embodied. And they do a lot of stuff in nature. So children go and learn outside. And I think some schools are coming around to realising the importance of that. There's more forest schools starting.
Yeah.
There's an amazing school in Eastbourne that, you know, they learn to go and, you know, kill an animal and cook it. Which
wow.
is quite, you know,
wow,
probably
amazing.
Upset some parents, but they learn to do that. And actually, gosh. You know, these they give these kids these survival skills, which helps the child feel capable.
Well, it instills a different kind of confidence, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
That self-reliance yeah. confidence, which is taken away because we live in a bit of a nanny state, don't we? Where
yeah.
we live in a state of constant fear and we're constantly
yeah.
telling children, don't do that, don't do this, don't do this. So children are brought up in a sense of fear and apprehension and trepidation about the world, which actually isn't preparing them for the world.
Yes. And they're also taught to pass an exam, which is definitely
a different
thing to being intelligent. You know, being intelligent is not about passing an exam necessarily. So the children that are really good at remembering stuff and, you know, kind
it's
of...
It's absolutely true.
It's yeah, you're teaching children to pass exams, which is not the same as giving them that kind of embodied education.
I've heard of something called family constellations.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Which I've never experienced, but a friend of mine has a couple of times. And it sounds fascinating. I mean, it's a different form of creativity, I guess.
Yeah.
But I suppose this is leading back into part of your introduction, where you work with mental health.
Mm.
How do you work in that space and what changes do you see in people?
So I used to volunteer at this crisis place and they would know that I was a counsellor, but they didn't know I was an art therapist quite often. So they would come to the sessions and then I'd have a box of crayons and they would literally be like, what is this? and it was like, I think with mental health, it's important to go very much at the client's pace. It's that gentle bringing the person back so that you can go into this sort of childlike play state, but also it's very safe to then transition back into your adult space. So it's kind of going between the two worlds in a safe way. Because actually, for some people who've experienced, you know, huge trauma, to go back there can be re-traumatizing and traumatic. So it's finding a very safe way and having your anchors, you know. So an example might be that you do a safe place meditation and you get the client to imagine this really safe place in their mind so that whenever you're doing work that can bring up fear and trauma, you can always go to that safe place and you've got that anchor. So it's kind of doing the work, and actually it takes time. Therapy does take time, and I'm not really so keen on the CBT 6-week kills everything method, because although it's really useful and it's really good at sort of helping people strategize and find ways to cope, it's very cognitive, as in the title cognitive behavior therapy, and it doesn't work in that kind of embodied way, where actually I think you can get to the very core of something, not just the symptom. You're going to that really young place in that person or that really old wound. But it takes time to get there. I always think of Alice in Wonderland when she goes down the hole.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
And also the thing is with mental health, I almost hate the word because we've all got mental health and we've all got stuff. And I think we have so many labels now, particularly with children as well, with autism and Asperger's, you know, the labels are helpful and, you know, it helps us realise, you know, some of the symptoms and things that are going on for them. But actually it's so important to always treat the person as an individual and to go into their story and not the kind of the label we have. Definitely with children as well.
Yeah.
It's always finding the individual.
Because we do have mental health, don't we? I mean, it's or emotional well-being.
Yeah.
You know, and it depends where on the scale that we are.
Yeah.
You know, is it very high? In other words, we're very balanced and we've dealt with our stress and we've got rid of past traumas and or is stuff still coming up from the past? And maybe some people don't have anything from the past.
I feel like everyone's always got stuff coming up from the past, whether we realise it or not.
You think?
It's kind of all, it was where we've come from. So if we imagine like a journey map, it's always going to be part of our journey. So we take it with us in some way. I mean, I kind of sometimes I'm amazed, you know, I sometimes have spent time with and know some homeless people who are like Zen Buddhist monks. You know, they may be drug addicts, they may be drinking, but they're going through the most, you know, hellish time we can possibly imagine. And yet there's something of great stillness in them. So I think wherever we are on the spectrum of what we consider mental health, you know, sane or not sane, or, you know, we maybe have done years of therapy, but it's all relative anyway. And there's always going to be parts of us that are polished and parts of us that are rusty, whether we've done years of therapy or not.
True.
And it's, I guess that it's, again, if we go to that young childhood place, we drop all that because when we see children, we see them as children. We don't think, oh, you're evolved and you're not. You know, we just they're just children. and we kind of, as we get older, we start to think that someone's good or someone's bad, and that judgment comes in.
True, the judgment comes in, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's coming in younger and younger now, don't you think?
Yeah.
Which is scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because kids have access to so much more than I did when I was growing up because of technology. Yeah. You know, so there is a dark and a light side to technology, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, it's wonderful because we're able to access information and learn more about the world, but the dark side of that is quite scary.
Yeah.
What we pick up.
Yeah.
We kind of lose, even as adults, I think we can lose a bit of our innocence.
Yeah. Oh, fully. And I think I think one of the practices is to return to that innocence. I've been doing all this work around fairy tales, and it's so beautiful.
What do you do? That's fascinating. What do you do? I mean, Grimm's fairy tales and the poetry, and that's really interesting.
Well, all of that, I mean, particularly the fairy tales, it takes us to this innocent childhood place. And I mean, I found, particularly in London, when I was in my 20s, and I think it's often the case now, because you know, women don't have children till their 30s. My 20s was literally socialising, was drinking and going to places.
Right.
And I just thought there was, you know, there was this real, I think before I decided to train in therapy and counselling, you know, there was this real sense of emptiness, thinking, oh, you know, is this what it is? Spending our money, going out for nice meals, you know, having a drink with friends, and it's great. But I realised I was longing for a sense of intimacy without all that. And so when I moved here, I made this sort of pact with myself to create these spaces where people could go into real, creative, beautiful, deep landscapes without any of those stimulants, just to allow themselves to. And it's so rich. It's so rich. And just to have those creative spaces where you kind of leave all the other stuff at the door, the adult stuff, and can play.
Mm.
And all adults suffer from over-responsibility, and we all need space to play. And if we give ourselves permission to play, we then give that permission to others. You know, if we've got, it's really important for adults who have got kids to be able to play themselves, so that they can then offer that to their kids.
And to be silly, and not always have to be sensible and grown up.
Yeah.
Because it's exhausting always being sensible and grown up.
Absolutely.
It's hard work.
We do, and we need to be random, and we need to be spontaneous, and we need to, you know, we also need to cry in front of each other and to...
and that's really tough.
Yeah.
It's really tough. I would say it's tougher for men, but I'm not sure it is. I think it's actually tough for everybody. You know, whatever your gender, I think sometimes...
Yeah.
And we always think men find it more difficult to show emotion, but I'm not sure if that's just a projection or if it's really true, because I think I don't think it is gender specific.
Actually. I think the gender subject is something I could go on about for hours.
Me both. We'll have another chat over a glass of wine then about that one.
Definitely. But I think I think men are generally brilliant at expressing anger, a lot of them. I mean, that's a real generalisation, but a lot of men are quite kind of at ease with their anger feelings, whereas women, I mean, I think that's in the nurture. You know, quite often girls are told that it's okay for them to cry, but they're not allowed to be angry, whereas boys are told you can be angry, but you can't cry.
Gosh.
So there's a lot of that.
All of that stereotyping and
But I would say, you know, on a bit of a side note, you know, when I work with clients, one of the main aspects of my work, and it's not something I went in with awareness of, but I would say maybe 100% of all my therapy work with clients is about them finding, if they're female, it's about them finding their masculine. Ah. And if they're male, it's about them finding their feminine.
Interesting.
And that is, finding that balance within the self of the masculine and the feminine is so important.
And oh boy, really is.
It's a never-ending journey, but there is something about that. And it, I guess I was always kind of spoils it by saying male and female. You could say yin and yang or another way of expressing it. But it's about finding that balance of the two sides. And it's a never-ending shift. But I do think a lot of our wounds come from stuff around gender. All the stuff around transgender stuff. Now it's all kind of coming to the fore. I think people are realising that there is so much trauma around gender.
There is huge.
I'm doing a walk in a couple of weeks of for a charity that works with young men in probation, mainly, who didn't have adequate relationships with their fathers.
Okay.
So it's a mentoring program for men to have male role models at whatever age.
Right.
To make up for the relationship they didn't have with their father, which is so moving.
Gosh.
And the work these men do with these other young men is incredible. And it's a lot of it's real kind of, you know, going out into the woods, doing a lot of initiations, ceremonies and things. But and it is so needed. And I think, there's so many. I mean, I think there's a lot of women that suffer with, you know, their relationship with their fathers. But also I think for men that don't have that relationship with their fathers, incredible.
It manifests in different ways, doesn't it?
It does,
So. Interesting. I mean, certainly with my experience of some of the environments that I work in is that I find a lot of women are very much in touch with their masculine side to the point where they have denied their feminine.
True. And I think I was thinking about this the other day, and I was thinking that the act of giving birth is, I don't know if I'm really, you know, it's quite a big thing to say, but I think the act of giving birth is very masculine. You know, that violence.
It's quite aggressive.
The violence
isn't it?
Of birth and the aggression and the power that, I mean, you know, the power required to give birth, you know, it's, there is something quite kind of, you know, rather than sort of saying male and female, but that masculine energy, that warrior, that fighter. So I think women go through that. I wonder how men kind of, you know, fight. I mean, I think men connect with women through marriage and through partnership, maybe. I don't know. There's a million things you could say about it. But, there's so much. I don't really know enough about everything, but
it's a fascinating subject.
Yeah,
I mean, when I do some of the leadership work I do, is I get people on the floor playing with colour and paint and feathers and glitter pens. So I turn up with all of this stuff, you know, glitter pens and lots of feathers and stickers, you know, stickers that you used to get as a kid and put them in books. And everybody has to get on the floor, and you see these men look at me, and you see the fear go through their eyes. Oh my God, how quickly can I get out of this room without causing offence? But I tell you, within 10 minutes, the jacket's off, the tie's off, the sleeves are rolled up, the shoes are off, they're on the floor, and they are, you are looking at a 5-year-old boy. And then they start laughing. I said, I can't believe you got me to do this, but this is so much fun.
It's wonderful. I know.
It's just about giving people permission, isn't it, of not having to be grown up and sensible.
I think it's also getting men through the door as well from whenever
these workshops. Yeah, I don't tell them what they're going
to
be doing.
You guys don't need to knock
to. And then I lock the door so they can't get out again.
My partner, he comes to my workshops and he has an amazing, I mean, the art he's produced is incredible. And I'm like, you're such an amazing artist. And he says, you know, I would never, you know, I'm obviously coming to these workshops for you, but actually they're brilliant. But I would never have come to them under any other circumstances if I wasn't supporting you.
Interesting.
And he gets so much out of them. And I've seen such an incredible side to him that I don't see in our everyday relationship. You know, something comes through when he's doing that process.
Interesting.
And I'm kind of, you know, that witnessing. Because actually when we witness, we see people in a different light, even if we know them, actually.
When
we truly witness, we see them, even, you know, in an intimate way, more than normal.
Is it scary for people to be seen? You know, do we, is there something about human nature that the way we think we can cope through this journey of life is actually to choose what is seen and what isn't, and to have this kind of cloak almost of invisibility, if you could quote Harry Potter, around us?
Well, it's all about, I think that's where shame comes in. Shame is such a huge part of therapy, and it's something that, you know, people always hate talking about, but it's... We're given that sense of shame from quite an early age, and it's like, oh, that's acceptable behaviour, that's not. And depending on what culture you grow up in, you know, you don't, the norms shift. But we learn that some parts of ourselves are deemed okay, some parts of ourselves are not. So we shut those other parts down, or we keep them hidden. And so sometimes our shyness and shame can come up when we are seen, but actually it's almost like, We can move through. If we actually embrace the shame and say, actually, this shame is totally welcome, it's completely welcome.
Gosh.
Then the most incredible things can happen. If we actually allow that shame to be fully there, we're not trying to push it away, we're not trying to, you know, we're just allowing it to be in the room. And you know, there's a really beautiful study I think I read about where it said that people that get embarrassed, and I definitely get embarrassed a lot, but... you know, people actually find it endearing when someone gets embarrassed. Yeah, and it was like, oh, actually, yeah, maybe actually people can see that I'm vulnerable and that's okay.
Yeah.
And we, you know, our vulnerability, I think, is our greatest strength.
But it kind of brings out a different side of the people who are witnessing that, isn't it? And particularly in Britain, we do love the underdog.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is good, but of course there is also a flip side to that.
Yeah.
Is that if people are very successful, part of the British culture is to knock them back down again. So that's the dark side of liking the underdog.
Yes. So that's an interesting part. So one part of my journey with therapy has been really interesting is that when I first started going to therapy, I was not in a good place. Like most people, you wait till things reach absolutely crisis point before you actually go and see someone. And it was, you know, years of unravelling, you know, trauma or fear or all this old stuff, old wounds. But actually, when I found it toughest in therapy was when I was with the positive, when I was with the goodness. It's so much harder for us to be with our positivity, our goodness sometimes, because we feel we don't deserve it. We feel, oh, is it okay to be happy? Is it okay to be abundant and to have made money doing something I love?
Interesting.
There's so much shame around
that.
Yeah,
interesting.
About, you know, we carry this, you know... So it can actually be harder for us to be with our goodness and our positivity than it is. And actually there's comfort in going, oh, well, you know, these wounds, oh, you know, there's something familiar about
them. Well, people bond over bad news, don't they? Yeah. Newspapers sell.
Yeah. Yes, you
know,
true.
I mean, there was an experiment, wasn't there? Recently, last year, about a newspaper that only printed good news. And it went under because nobody bought it.
Wow.
I mean, what kind of reflection is that of human nature?
Oh, that's terrifying, isn't it?
Because there's something about people feeling good about where they are.
Yeah.
If they read about disasters that are going on that don't involve them.
Yeah.
They say, oh, okay, well, my life's not that bad then. Yeah. Suddenly you can start to feel good about yourself. Yeah. It's a very mixed up thing. It's fascinating.
This is really
I can't believe we're nearly at 50 minutes. This is crazy. It's gone like five. So what does the future hold for you, Anna? Where are you taking all of this?
So my next step is to get over this hurdle of finding it hard to be with the positive and the good. And to take... I mean, I feel like things are naturally expanding anyway. I'm kind of hoping to do way more workshop stuff. And at the moment, I just do it in a local scout hut.
Okay.
Is all, you know, I started very small and it's taken me years to build things up. And but I, you know, I want to bring it to more people.
Right.
Because the people that come are just mainly my friends. And okay. They say, oh, this is great, you know. And so, you know, I've got fear in taking it to bigger places. But that is the plan. And I think... but also just to trust that actually there's a flow to it and things will naturally expand. So if we start small and we do those tiny steps, it will naturally bring us to bigger things. And I think finding the trust within that, finding the safe boundaries within that, and taking those baby steps really.
Fantastic.
And yes, doing more work on gender, I think that's definitely something I need to do.
Fascinating. I can see a whole art therapy workshop on gender. Brilliant. Yeah. Thank you. It's been a joy. So interesting. Yeah. I could carry on for another 50 minutes. Absolutely brilliant. Fascinating. Thank you, Anna.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Katie Day and Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. As women, we are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.